Welcome to Funny Story Live. I'm Annalise Griffin, editor-in-chief of Brooklyn-based. Each month, we co-curate a storytelling show at the Brooklyn Brewery with comedian Tom Chalou. There are no themes or rules, just beers, stories, and good times. This podcast was produced from our first show of 2015, back in January, and it was so good that we couldn't fit all the stories into one episode, so we've saved a few for a later podcast. Let's get things started with a winter-appropriate story from Tom about the Great Blizzard of 78.
So I thought I would talk about, it's been so cold, I've been thinking about 1978. The Blizzard of 78! Young people don't even know what I'm talking about when I say that. A couple of years ago I ran into someone and I mentioned the Blizzard of 78 and they were like, oh, you know, I wasn't even born in 78. And I was like, what? You're a fully grown human and you weren't born in 1978? I thought little children weren't born in 78. And she was like, I was born in the 90s. And I was like, oh my God. And now that's not even weird. You were probably not even born in the 90s, were you? You were, what year? 92, the year I moved to New York. Think of it. I'm moving to New York. I'm a full-on adult trying to make my way in the world. And he was a little babe in a basket. And now we're hanging out, me and him. We're like friends now. It's amazing. I think that, you know, I'm always shocked by time, by age. Do you guys realize that Colin Hanks isn't even close to being young anymore? He's not even a young man, Colin Hanks. Think about that. So in 1978, I was at that perfect stage. Like, I felt like I was kind of getting to be a grown-up then in 78. You know, like I was breaking up. We were getting out and we were exploring the world on our own. And the best time to explore the world was on a snow day.
Snow day.
Snow day, exactly. It's like I'm in church. I say snow day and this guy's giving me a hallelujah. Snow days were like... And this was in the time, in the late 70s in Massachusetts. I mean, the winters lasted all winter. Like, it was like, if you had a snow day, it was going to be 2 days. Because that's how long it took them to clear snow. We were so inundated. And the Blizzard of 78 was talked about, like, my whole childhood. I swear, there were two things that I was hearing about all during the 70s. One was the bicentennial. The bicentennial, my whole childhood, like that's all we did in school was make bicentennial dioramas. In an art class, we'd be like, okay, we're gonna make a bicentennial plate. And it was like, my whole childhood was the bicentennial. And then at some point, they started talking about the Blizzard of 78, way before it had come. They were like, the Blizzard of 78. You know, they don't do that now. Like, they don't call things by that kind of grand name now. You know, like... You know, like even the Great Crash of 1929, they didn't call it that for like 10 years. But the Blizzard of 78, they were calling it that in 78. And the meteorologists, they were like, it's coming. The Blizzard of 78 is coming. And then when it came, we were like, oh my God, it's right on schedule. You know, it was the legendary snowstorm. And that's when Michael Dukakis made his bones. Do you remember Michael Dukakis from 92? Remember when you were a little baby watching the debates on TV? Michael Dukakis... It was like, you know, he ran for president in 92, but he came of age, or was it 90? Was it 90? Oh, it was 88? Yeah, sorry. You're right. 92 was Bush Clinton, Texas guy. So 88, he ran for president. 78 is when it started. It was the Blizzard of 78. Don't think it was anything else. He was on TV in his cable knit sweater. Michael Dukakis shoveling snow in that Irish turtleneck sweater. It was such, you know, that Greek head of his sticking out of that Irish sweater. That was about as multicultural as things got in Massachusetts back then. And they were like, he's all American. He's an immigrant in a sweater and he's shoveling snow. You know, Kitty inside was like making soup or something. We thought she was making soup. You don't know what Kitty was doing. She was like She was having a lot of trouble. Does anyone remember Kitty? She was like sucking on speed stick. Like, they took all the alcohol out of the house, and she had, that was her famous story. She wrote, she was sucking on roll-ons to get the alcohol out of them. And he was shoveling snow. So that's where it all began. And when the snows first came down, school was canceled. We used to listen to, this is pre-internet. You don't understand what pre-internet was like. There was no, you know, you had to go to the radio, turn on the radio in the morning and listen to which schools were canceled. And they would list all the schools in Massachusetts. They'd be like Auburn, Ajax, Anthrax, like every town. You're like, what are these towns? There was like 110 towns that began with A. And then they'd move on to B's, Braintree, Brookline. And so they finally would get to N. And even N, like Norwood, it took like 40 towns before they got to know. There's so many Nors. It's like Norwell, Norwich. I'm like, say my town. And they would say Norwood, and we would celebrate. And we'd have some oatmeal, and then we'd run out into the snows. And it was like, it was so deep in 78. I remember it started in the late afternoon the day before, and then we just watched it piling up, so we knew school was going to be canceled. And it was so thick the next day, and it just kept snowing. And then they would try to get out there with the plows and plow it, and they would make the snowbanks, and then it snowed on top of the snowbanks. So you had these drifts that were 17, 18, 19 feet high. Yeah, they were going up the side of buildings. Entire houses were buried. There was just smoke coming out of a hole. And so it started, of course, with a snowball fight. So we're out there having our morning snowball fight. It was me and Perkins and Mittaguy against Big Perkins and Rob Morrissey. Big Perkins, older brother to John Perkins, who was Little Perkins, or we called him Twink. His name was Twerp at first. He was a small boy, so we called him Twerp. And then he got tired of that name, so he switched it to Twink. We all had multiple nicknames back then. I was Little Shaloo for a while, and because I had an older brother. So if you had an older sibling, you were Little, so I was Little Shaloo. And then my name was Tom, so I was Tomboy for a while. They called me Tomboy, and then they called me Zomboy. And then Zomboy became Zoid. So at that point, I was Zoid, and he was Twerp. So we're out there, and we're me and Little Perkins, we're having our snowball fight. And it was 3-2, but they were a full year older than us, Big Perkins and Morrissey. So they were beating us with their superior arms, and they could pack that snow so tight. And we didn't know how they did it. It was such light snow in the blizzard of 78, but they were able to pack it. I don't know what they used. They found slush or moisture somehow, but they packed these tight snowballs, and they were pummeling us, and we were running away from them in Shattuck Park, and we were getting snowballs off the back of the head, and very painful right there, and the brainstem shot. And so we fled through Shattuck Park, through the cemetery, and down to my house, and we ran into my basement. And we had those little wooden doors, you know, like this. They looked like this barrel, and they were short, but we were just that perfect height, 12-year-olds, to run into the basement. Open the door, we ran inside the basement, slammed the door, and then the snowballs, you could hear them off the door. And we were like laughing in the basement, ha ha ha, and we were dripping on the floor. Again, they were hitting the door to show us they were out there. And then my dad came out from the blanket. He had a blanket that was nailed up to the beam in the basement, and he had his office. My dad dwelt in the basement. He would come home from work, and everyone would run. My dad was the most feared dad in the neighborhood. All dads were mean back then, but my dad was meaner. So they were extra scared of him. And he would come home from work, and he would open the door of his car and get out. And he had his suit on, and he would glare at everyone, and they would all run. People would just run when my dad came home for no reason. They didn't do anything wrong. And then they would run through the hedges. We had hedges in our yard, and they would run through the hedges, which drove my dad crazy. So he would yell at them. He'd be like, God damn it, get out of my hedges. And they'd flee home. But I don't know if it was some kind of vicious circle, like, you know, once they started running, they would go through his hedges, which made him yell, which made them run all the more. So it just never ended. Then my dad would go inside and put his khakis and sneakers on, and then he would go downstairs into the basement. He would smoke cigars, and he would kind of watch his little black and white TV, and he had a key punch machine there, and he would do work on his key punch machine, which was a Honeywell device, the precursor to the home computer, which you're familiar with. And so it was this massive key punch machine. It was like, and cards would go through it, and he would do some kind of work in there. So, of course, we ran in the basement. We wouldn't have run in if we knew my dad was there, because usually on a snow day, Dad would go to work, and we would be able to play, and we would be in and out of the house demanding food and whatnot, and my dad was never there. But the blizzard of 78 was so intense, people had to cancel work, so he was in the basement. So we were there dripping all over his precious granite floor, and he came out of that blanket, "What the hell is going on here?" And then he walked up to us, and then against that wooden door. And so he walked right towards the door. My dad wanted to see what's going on. He walked to the door, and I was like, "No!" I knew it was out there. I was like, "Ooh!" I tried to stop him, but God damn it! And he opened the door, and then it was like, we were here, you know. And he opened the door, and he's like, just snowballs bashing off my dad. And we're looking through his legs, like we're little kids. I'm looking through my dad's legs, and I can see Morrissey and Big Perkins are like, and then they would let it go. They're like, they started running right when they released, like, and then my dad was like, "God damn it." And so between my dad's legs, I saw Morrissey and Perkins running away, which gave me some satisfaction. And then my dad turned to us, and his wrath came out. "Get the hell out of here. You're gone till sundown." And we ran out the door, and he slammed it, and we ran off into the snow. Now, we were all scared of my dad, but just that wonderful moment, you know, watching Big Perkins and Morrissey pummeling my dad, it created a kind of solidarity. So we caught up with them, and we had a kind of a laugh, and we went downtown, all of us together. So the war was over, and it was all five of us. We went downtown Norwood, and there were these great buildings of Norwood. Kind of adding some drama to it. The great buildings of Norwood, which you all know so well. And, you know, these were like six-story buildings. Klein's Department Store, Jack's Drum Shop. You know what I'm talking about. And we climbed up on the buildings because they had fire escapes in the back, because you could reach the fire escapes finally because the snow was so high, pushed there into a snowbank from the snowplows in the driveway, and then piled up more with snow. So we climbed up onto the fire escapes, and we went up onto the buildings, and all the buildings connected in downtown Norwood. And so we got up there, and we went across all the buildings, and we were jumping off in all our favorite places in the back. There was an alley back there, and they would have kind of cars parked and dumpsters or whatever, but now they were all covered with snow. So the drifts, like I said, were 20 feet high, and we were up there 50 or 60 feet. So it was this wonderful opportunity. So we started jumping off of the back of the buildings. And we're all landing in the snow, all of us except Perkins. Twink was not jumping. Twink was, like I said, he was a skinny boy, and he was there just watching us. And we let him out a lot. Twink didn't do a lot of stuff. He had a kind of he was always stuffed. He always had a stuffy nose. And so he would be given a pass. You know, Twink, you don't have to play kill the kid with the ball. You get that post-nasal drip going on. And so he was standing there watching us. But we were encouraging him. We wanted to get him to jump into the snow. So we were encouraging him from below. We were like, "You fairy," you know. That's, again, the 70s. You've got to understand, this is the way boys encouraged each other. We were like we were like Anthony Robbins, you know. We wanted him to jump into the snow. We wanted him to see his dreams realized. So we yelled fairy at him, you know. It's so ironic because you would never have kids. I don't think kids yell fairy anymore. They're so, you know, they're instructed in conflict resolution and all this stuff in schools. And I don't think that kids get away with doing that kind of a thing. And it's ironic, because I think if you yelled fairy at a kid today, the kid wouldn't care. Like a fourth grade boy would be like, "Yeah, what? Like Elsa, the Queen of the North? She's great." Like the fairies are like so, they're like the leads in movies now. Even when you see, like, have you seen Tinkerbell, what she looks like? She's got like, her legs are like speed skater legs. Like, Tinkerbell is so tough, you know? So I don't even think it would work on kids anymore. But nevertheless, we were like doing our best to encourage him. And he was looking down, and we teased him enough, and he finally got up the guts to jump. And so I'm in there in the snow, like up to my chest in snow, and I see Perkins jump. And he jumped off, and he closed his eyes, and he jumped, you know, and he's just going down like this, like full straight. Like he had a kind of a ragdoll quality about him. He wasn't tucking. I could see it was going to go well. Because when you jump off of roofs, as you know, you have to tuck. You've got to bring the knees up. Yes, you got to tuck. And you want to go with your butt and your knees in at the same time, kind of cannonball style. And then the snow kind of accepts you, you know, and you go, you plunge down 2.5 feet and you land softly. But if you go in, arms and legs gangly, he was going gangly style. You know, he was doing it, he was whooping it gangly style. And he was coming down with the limbs all in all directions. And he's coming down. And like I said, he was not only a stuffy kid, he was a milk drinker, you know? They couldn't get him to drink water. He was just a milk drinker. So he had that really thick snot, you know? It had qualities to it. It had a thickness, you know, like a workman's putty. And it was always there at the ready, you know? He always had that little ball on one side, like a little yellow ball that was kind of, it looked like a lottery ball just hanging down there. And then he would sniff and it would go up, it would disappear, and then it would return. So he's gangling down and I'm looking at him and he lands in the snow and his feet hit the snow. And when his feet hit the snow, immediately they rush up to his chest. His knees hit himself in the chest. And when your lungs get hit, it's kind of like a bellows. The air rushes out of your orifices. Now, he had his mouth closed tightly and his eyes closed tightly. So he just had that nose. And so he hit, and then the air rushed out of him, and these two thick strands of putty-like snot shot out of his nose. I was there in the snow. I saw it happen. He didn't. His eyes were closed, so he landed, and his head kind of pushed forward like that, and the air came out, and these two ropes snaked into the snow. It was like shot in, and they coiled up into the snow. And then he opened his eyes, and he involuntarily, when you get the wind knocked out of you, you don't even know you're doing it. He just sucked in like that, and these two strands of snow-covered snot shot up his nose. They snaked in his head. You know, like, and do you know how many miles of nasal passage you have? Have you ever seen one of those posters from the side? I think it's like 40 miles of nasal passage, something like that. But he had snow-covered snot snaking through his whole head. You know when the worst ice cream headache you've ever had? I mean, just think about it. And he didn't know what had hit him. That was the thing about Perkins. Like, I saw the whole thing. And then he sucked and he looked at me. So he landed and he was like, oh, I didn't get hurt. And then he was just like, you imagined, he thought this great headache of his, like he just like came from jumping out of off a building. So of course, and then he let out that scream. You know, he looked like the cover of National Geographic. He was like, you know, like that famous baboon. You know what I'm talking about? Now that I had witnessed that. You see, the blizzard of 78, okay? That was the winter of 1978. So it's known for the blizzard of 78. Everyone knows that. But only I know that winter in 1978, that was the site of the most intense brain freeze in history. And it all happened in 1978. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you for that. We started it off. Now's the chance for me to kind of sit back and watch stories. This is why I do this show. I tell a story, which I love doing, of course, and I also love having beers and sitting around and listening to stories. So I invite people to this show, comedians that I know, writers that we meet. Brooklyn-based helps me book this show, and we find all sorts of fabulous Brooklyn personalities. So we always put together an eclectic show, and there's usually, you know, it's always unique. So let me introduce this first guy. He actually was introduced to me by some people who come here regularly. And I went to his website, you know, they say, oh, check this guy out. And I said, okay. So of course I Googled him and it's like, oh great, he's got a bunch of web videos he made. Boom, you know, and I started watching his web videos. They're so good. You have to Google this guy and find his, what's the web series called? Can you tell me the website, John? Good Cop, Great Cop. I mean, it's so good. Like, we're all inundated with web videos, and it's so refreshing to go to a site and just, I was just laughing the whole time. It was so excellent, and I was like, please come do my show. Like, it went from me being like, yeah, I'll do your friend a favor, whatever, and then I called him. I'm like, I'm hitching myself to your wagon, buddy. Let's welcome Charlie Hankin.
How are you guys doing? Oh, good. In the autumn of 2010, I went to go do pub trivia at Pete's Candy Store right here in Williamsburg. Never heard of it? How could that be? No, you've heard of it, I can tell. They do very serious trivia night there, and I'm not a big trivia person, but I went with some friends. I went with my brother and my brother's friends. We were on a team that was called, I'll just spell it, all one word, G-A-Y-M-O-V-E-R. So that at the end of the night, we had the joy of hearing the guy running the trivia thing say, in fourth place, game over? Or game mover? So mission accomplished. And of course we came in fourth because trivia wasn't really our thing. But there were some people there that night who were just there to get drunk and blow off some steam after work. And they left some flyers for the TV show that they worked on. And that show was Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And this story is the story of how I was a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And thank you. And I hope that it's also a little bit instructional. My goal is for everybody to go out and be on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Everybody should go do it because the downsides are minimal, right? Worst case scenario, you embarrass yourself on national TV, and it never goes away. It's just, it's on YouTube for good, and there's nothing you can do about it. But you get $1,000, and that's for real. If you guys go do, you really should try out and do it, because even if you turf out, if you get a question wrong and theoretically walk away with nothing, you don't walk away with nothing. The consolation prize is $1,000. So please take it seriously, and I'll take you through my experience of it a little bit. So the flyers tell you to go to ABC's cafeteria. It's 67th Street. Really, go do this, for real, I'm telling you. 67th Street between Central Park West and like the Lincoln Square area. And you show up, and the show's in syndication, so they make it all the time. You show up with maybe 100 other people who've driven to New York from wherever to try and take the application test for this thing. Now, the test is just a Scantron thing. It looks just like the SATs, and I'm not looking down my nose at this, it's easy. It's anybody can take it. That's not a superiority thing. I will give you an example of real questions on this. I'm helping you cheat. I'm sure they've revised the test since I took it in 2010. But sample questions for this include, which one of these faces isn't on Mount Rushmore? And you just have to know, okay, so maybe you don't know that much about Teddy Roosevelt, but you're pretty sure that Ronald Reagan is not on Mount Rushmore. So that's good enough. Or what is the name of the convenience store clerk on television's hit series, The Simpsons? For real. You know, no Nahasa Pima Petalon or any, it's just Apu. So if this seems like it's within your comfort zone, you should definitely go do it. So you're sitting in this cafeteria, and they grade the test on the spot, and I would estimate that maybe 10 people were asked to come meet the producers. So you just have to do better than everybody else, but no, it's not that hard. And then you get to go talk to the producers, and they just make sure that you're not weird. And then they ask you to do a little camera test. You go to another room, you talk into a camera, and they say, what would you do with $1 million? And you have to be like, well, I genuinely think that travel broadens the mind. They just want to make sure that you're not going to be like, I don't know, well, I'm a murderer, so I'd probably keep that up even if I was a millionaire. And then you're allowed to go on TV, basically, is how it works. Or in my case, I had to wait a year. Basically, you just have to wait for a phone call. So that was in like the fall, winter of 2010. I had to wait until November of 2011 to actually get a call. And I got a call at work, actually. So I work as a tutor, it's being millionaires. All my clients are millionaires or billionaires, and it was a very weird experience. I mean, it's still true, but it was a very weird experience for me at the time. I sort of knew it. Like, when I actually got the phone call from Millionaire, I was tutoring a kid who needed to reschedule a session because she had to. She was flying one day with her dad to go to the Grammys. And I wasn't supposed to know that because they didn't want to. I just found out by accident, basically, that was the scheduling conflict. So I remember actually that day turning to the dad, who's like show business guy, and saying, "So you guys are going to the Grammys?" And he was like, "Yeah, elevator's right down there." And then I got to leave. So it was like very. That's my vibe of dealing with day to day at work. And then I get this call that tells me that I have this opportunity to go on this game show. After expecting nothing, because a year is such a long time. So what do you do when you find out that you're going to be on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? This is what you guys should do when you do it. Correct. Who said that? You said that. The correct answer is you study. Everybody hear that? Study is the right answer. How do you study for trivia? Do you know how to study? Do you have experience in this department? You don't know how to study for trivia? I didn't know how to study for trivia either. I had to look it up. The way you do it is you buy books of trivia. They exist. They're real things. They're basically just wall-to-wall facts. And you tutoring doesn't help me with like trivia, nonsense, pop culture, whatever. But I do know how to study. It's something that I can take seriously and figure out how to do. So you pick up the book, and you just try to read as much as you can. And you think the next day about what you learned. When they call you to do this, you have about 3 weeks. They tell you with maybe 2-3 weeks notice that you're going to come in for your taping. So I went to Barnes & Noble, went on Union Square. I went there Sunday morning. It was totally dead. Me, one other person inside, and I got my first omen, my first taste that something interesting was in store. I had a sign from the universe. I walked into there, and this one other person is standing by the escalators there on the first floor, and we lock eyes for a second. And she turns away and barfs right onto the floor. That's 100% true. And like, it's what bookstore? No, how do you deal? There's no one. No, people there are prepared to put books onto shelves or take books off of the shelves. Someone had to just figure out, okay, now I get to conquer my gag reflex because I didn't sign up for this, but this is just a Sunday morning for me now, apparently. So I was like, okay, it's a sign from the universe. This game show thing is bound to work out. You go up to the second floor, and there is a trivia section. So you buy things that are like phone book size things called an incomplete education or cultural literacy. You just do the best you can. And I wish I could remember all of the stuff that I knew for like 2 seconds. Because part of the theory about this is that you cram, and then the second the show is over, you forget it all. It's just like grade school again. Everybody here knew at some point what the 15 squared was. But when was the last time you needed to know what 15 times 15 was off the top of your head? You memorized it, and then it went away. That's the same way that it works on trivia. So at one point, I knew all the names for the parts of a diamond ring. I want to say that one of them is a... cradle? I don't know. Why not? I really have no idea what happened with that thing. Morganatic marriage is one in which you give up some status when you marry someone with less of a title than you. It's a society term. Great that I know that in the 21st century as an American, but that's the only one of, there's like 9 types of marriage, scandals like that, that all have names. The only one that I remember. So what else do you do to study for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Because you know, books are good. Correct! You watch the show, right? So I was very lucky. Clara, a friend of mine who's in the audience right now, has cable. I guess you don't need cable. She had a television. And I watched some episodes of the show because I realized what was in my mind about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is not actually the show that's on TV. If you're picturing Regis Philbin, you're picturing the wrong thing. I was there during Meredith Vieira's tenure on the show. Currently, I think, does anybody know who hosts it now? Someone else? a lot of Howie Mandel. It's I think you might be thinking of, is that Deal or No Deal that he hosts? Yeah, okay. I think Cedric the Entertainer took it over, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't seen an episode in years at this point. But anyway, so you watch the show and you realize that they've changed the format of this. You will need to know this when you go on the show. Phone a friend doesn't exist anymore. Neither does 50-50. Your only lifelines are poll the audience, and you have two opportunities to jump the question. You can't skip the question, you jump the question, because ABC owns a trademark on jump the question, but not skip the question. The difficulty and dollar amount of the questions are randomized. So it used to be ascending order of difficulty. Those days are over. Your very first question could be super duper hard and worth $500, as opposed to like $10,000 or whatever. After the first however many questions, you're allowed to play Millionaire Classic, which is just basically increasing dollar amount, increasing difficulty, and those questions start at $100,000, $250,000, half million, and million. That's Millionaire Classic, okay? So I watched some episodes of the show, try to get a feel of what was gonna be on it, and then it was my turn, as it will be your turn when you do it. So what do you do when you show up at ABC Studios? Well, they take you through a metal detector. They show you the studio for a second. It's not as big as you might think. And they make sure that you're comfortable there. Everybody, you're in a group of other contestants. Everybody's freaked out. It's a lot of dudes who are like doing like practice questions and then freaking out when it doesn't go really well. And then they lead you back to the green room where the producers explain a little bit of what to expect. So for one thing, they will tell you that this isn't Regis's show anymore. When Regis was on the show, Regis was the center of attention. You might be the guest, you might be the contestant on there, but that show is about Regis. If he could find some detail about you to home in on, if he was like, oh, look at your shoes, you're the shoe guy, look at your shoes, oh my God, if you wear the shoes, you're gonna have the blues. And that was Regis, but that's not what Meredith is. Meredith is a supporter. She's solid as a rock. She feels those ups, she feels those downs, and she's with you every step of the way. So you just need to be able to like deal with her energy because it's very emotionally invested. And then you learn the word, the buzzword, that the producers want in your brain the whole time you're playing. That word is courage. It's a very weird idea because to this day, I don't know whether this actually, they pitch it as the strategy for the game. You need courage. This is about risk taking because you're gonna be tempted to wanna walk away. You walk away from the game, this is actually part of the new reformatting. You walk away from the game at any point, you actually only keep half the money that you banked. It's just the rule. If you've seen, you know, a $10,000 question and a $5,000 question, you have $15,000 banked, but then you suddenly decide you can't play anymore, you only walk home with $7,500, okay? But courage also makes for really good TV. So who do you trust? I still don't know. We'll find out how courage worked for me on this show in a minute. But so they want you to be courageous, and then you basically just have to chill until it's your turn. And you watch the other people in the room get called to go in. You never hear from them again. You don't see them again. And then you wait for it to be your turn. That first day, I never got my turn. I was one of the few people who were from New York. I could come back the very next day, which is what I did. Clara, again, was in the audience waiting to see me go up that first day. I never showed. We went out for drinks afterwards. It was fine. Whatever. Sorry. Are you fine with that happened? Okay. Again, I had no control over it, but I'm sure it was, like, annoying. Okay. Good. So I went back the next day, and then my turn did come around. So this may be a little bit less instructional, but I'll give you a little sense of my experience on this show. Because maybe you can take something away from it when you go on. Everybody should go on. The wheels stayed on the wagon for a while. For a little while. I have a couple, and I didn't like black out or anything, but I definitely don't remember every question. But I can definitely say that you know, the very first one that you walk out through the studio, and then there's like 50 people over here in stands, and 50 people over here in stands, and 50 people over here in stands, and then just the screen in front of you, and you just stand next to Meredith. And it's like playing like a too big video game, basically. And the first question comes up, and it's something like, which of these birds has a cone-shaped face that directs sound to its ears? And the options were like a swallow, an owl, a crow, or a sparrow. Which one is it? Owl, right? Yeah, right. So it's an owl, it's all fine. So really, they, you know, they don't try to trick you that much. My one moment of genius, not really a moment of genius. You see how you guys stack up? Probably, we'll see what happens. This is the term for the pleasurable form of fear that you experience on a roller coaster. Is it endostress, ectostress, eustress, or protostress? Proto versus ecto. That's your 50-50. The Greek prefix eu, as in euphoria or euthanasia, right? Good death. Eu and thanasia, thanatos, I don't know. It's the best I could do. That was my moment of brilliance. Everybody gets one. You're allowed to have one. So that worked out okay. And then the wheels fell off the wagon. Then I flew a little too close to the sun. I got seduced by those lifelines. I will tell you, that courage thing is not nothing. It's a real thing. You want to be able to play as if you're in your living room at home, as if the money is not real and as if this is just a game. But it's hard, because the second you start to bank money, you start to rationalize all sorts of conservative behaviors. Well, you know, maybe I've banked 20 grand at this point. But I could do a lot with 10 grand if I just walked away. So you start to play a little bit more conservatively, which is not good television and also not a good way to walk home with a ton of money. But you'll learn from my mistakes. So the money started to get a little too real for me when they asked, like, which one of these amusingly named forms of money is commonly traded currency in Vietnam? Well, of course, the funniest option there is dong, but I didn't know if it was dong, so I jumped the question. Guess what? It was dong. But this is actually going to be hard for me to talk. This is still upsetting to me. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Then comes the question, which one of these pop singers has never appeared topless on the cover of Rolling Stone? I polled the audience, and they overwhelmingly said Beyoncé, which makes perfect sense. Because Beyoncé, she's not a Christina Aguilera garbage person. She's sophisticated. Of course she would never be topless on the cover of Rolling Stone. But that money was getting to me, and I used my second jump the question. I burned through two lifelines on one question, and that was when the wagon started to skid to a halt, because the final question, which one of these presidential daughters was born on the 4th of July? Was it like Chelsea Clinton? Was it Bush daughter? Was it Malia Obama? It was like, you either know it or you don't. And if you don't know it, you better hope you still have a jump the question, which I didn't. So I had to walk away. But I had banked $39,500 at that point. So I walked away with $19,750, which was a hugely, thank you, hugely, thanks guys, hugely important amount of money at the time. For me, trying to figure it out as an artist, that was what allowed me to take a little bit more risks in my personal life and try and like carve some time out to do some stuff that could help establish a little bit of my art practice. And Tom mentioned some videos that I was able to do. In fact, if you want to Google "Good Cop, Great Cop," we used footage from the Millionaire episode in an episode called Money. So you check it out. So what do you expect after you play the game? Well, you can expect to be recognized by random weirdos. That happened to me. Hey, you on Millionaire the other day? Yeah, I was. How could you not fucking know Beyonce? So you can expect that to happen to you. And you also find out who in your talent pool, your contestant pool, turfed out. That was really interesting. Saw some very, very confident people backstage who really couldn't figure it out. Walked away with $1,000, which is great. Everybody should do that. So you get a little bit of closure on that. And you get this. This is a card from Meredith Vieira. I'm going to read it to you. Dear Charlie, you did a great job. I hope you had fun hanging with us, and I'm sure your parents will be proud, even if you didn't let them know about it, which is true. I did not tell my parents I was going on the show. I've told them about it later. Enjoy your $19,750, XOXOXO, Meredith. P.S., if you're ever in Westchester County and want to hang out, give me a call, followed by a phone number. Can you just verify that this is a handwritten letter? And do you see where it says PS at the bottom?
Oh my God.
Do you see where it says PS? Yeah? See where it says that right there? Can you read that PS there at the bottom? There is no PS. I made that last part up. Didn't happen. Thanks, guys.
Charlie Hankin. Did they verify that was really from Meredith Vieira?
Sorry?
Did they verify that is from Meredith Vieira?
Only if you're a handwriting expert. You'd ever know.
That's amazing. Let's hear it again for Charlie Hankin. She seems like she'd be very... I bet you could... You never called her, did you? You should hang out with her when you're on the Upper West Side.
She seems very, very nice.
I'm sure. I think she's genuine. And she is nicer. You know, it's interesting because that show... Do you remember how mean it was when it started? It was like they were mean to the people, and they tried to mess with their minds. And then as it's gone on, every host has been nicer and nicer. Interesting, right? I once did a show on the Upper West Side, and Diane Sawyer came to it because Mike Nichols was coming, because someone had studied at the Mike Nichols Acting Institute or something that was in the show, and so he was there, and she came as well. So he came back, and he was like, hey, guys, great show. Like, he came in, and he gave us, like, the Mike Nichols, like, hey, everything was great. Like, he's Mike Nichols. So we were all like, I can't believe Mike Nichols just saw our show, like our sketch comedy show. And he was like, great, great job, guys. It was really great, you know. And she was waiting there. Like, she's dressed up really well, and she looks fantastic. And she's waiting for Mike Nichols to do his thing because it's a tiny dressing room back there. And I never forget what she said. I will never forget what she said. And then he says his thing, and he kind of backs off. And he's like, all right, there goes Diane. So she sticks her head in, and she kind of looks at us all like this. She looks us all in the eye. And then she says, there's a smile at the heart of this show that comes straight from all of you. And she walked away. I mean, is that so classic Diane Sawyer or what? That's intense. I feel like this show is... I do a lot of shows. I do comedy shows, I do storytelling shows, and, you know, sometimes these kind of literary readings or something. But a lot of them, I feel like they are... radio stations, you know, like, and but they have their genre, like it's like smooth jazz, like it's you've got your genre of show and everyone kind of understands it, and then you do a comedy show and it's like, you know, it's in a club and that's the, you know, that's its own radio station. But I feel like this show, I was just thinking as I sat back, that this show is like a college radio station where you have no idea what the hell is going to happen next, you know, like you're like, what genre of show is this? And because we keep switching, you know, you have Frank Sinatra and then you've got like Black Flag. It's like, it's definitely, okay. Our next storyteller, is an author. He's written books like Dutch Uncle, The Cuba Project. Let's welcome Peter Pavia. He's right there in the audience watching the show. Come on up, Peter.
Hello, everybody. I'm a big Tom Shalhoub fan. I know Tom, but only through his myriad successes. I think that he has a website that'll probably spell it all out for you. But he sometimes pinch hits as a host on one of my favorite television shows, Red Eye. It's on really late, but you guys are probably up anyway, right? Worrying about money and your careers. That's me. I don't know. That's what I'm doing. I'm awake at 3 a.m. And I'm worried about money and my career. I'm staring at the ceiling or at Tom Shalhoub's face on my television screen, worrying about my career and money. I know that a lot of you guys know me as a bartender, and God knows at this point, I've probably made, about a billion Manhattans. But I've always been a writer, like the bio says. I'm an author. And I never really wanted to be anything else. I mean, I've been a writer my whole life. When I was a kid, some of you may remember the Scholastic book catalog that they gave you, right? It was like a newspaper catalog that they gave you in college. In one quarter, they were offering a poster of Ernest Hemingway. So I bought the poster of Ernest Hemingway. And when it came in, I took 4 thumbtacks, and I pinned it to the wall above my bed. It had featured the Papa Hemingway phase, like with the gray flecked beard. Did someone mention Irish knit cable turtleneck? Was that you, Tom? Well, in that picture, Hemingway was wearing an Irish knit cable turtleneck, steely eyes, but like a kind face, right? That's exactly what I wanted to be. I had never read one word that the man had written. I didn't know how I was going to get there, but that's who I wanted to be. Ernest Hemingway was my hero. So I'm going back now to it wasn't 78, but maybe 79. And of course, in addition to being a bartender and along the way to being a writer, I've done a lot of different jobs. Security guard, sandwich maker. And in this winter that I'm thinking about, I was a car salesman for an auto dealer that was named after the founder of the business, Jim Volpe. Jim Volpe sold Lincolns and Mercurys. And I'm 19 years old. I'm living at my mother's house. It's the dead nuts winter. Middle of a winter in upstate New York. Once again, a theme has been established here. Feet of snow on the ground. When it wasn't snowing, it had just finished snowing, or it was threatening to snow. And I'm living with my mother. In addition to being broke, which I was, I didn't have any wheels either. And I felt like, wow, I really need a car. I was looking through the want ads in a newspaper. Want ads, remember want ads? Does anybody remember newspapers? I circled this ad that said, wanted, auto sales, EXP preferred, but will train. And the magic word, demo. They gave you a car to drive. A demonstration model. In the nomenclature, a demo. So I show up for my interview the next day, and it's with Vinny, the sales manager. I'm a younger guy, you know, sitting at his desk, munching on a tuna fish sandwich. He's got a Terry Tin burning in the ashtray. It's all right, he lights up another one. He's got 2 cigarettes going. He's eating the tuna fish sandwich that he apologizes for, and he says, you know, somebody once gave me a break, so I'm going to give you a break. So I started the next day. Vinny talked fast. Vinny was loud. Vinny was full of shit in the way that all car salesmen are full of shit. And he had this oily confidence that he had absolutely no right to. Troubled beyond his years. He had this wavy mane of black hair. And troubled beyond his years, he was busting out of a marriage. He's probably like in his mid-20s at this time, busting out of a marriage to the quintessential Rochester cutie, a jewel of Italian-American lineage. She looked just like Vinny. And they had a little girl who could not help but resemble them both. Now, the chief attraction to this job was that demo and the washouts that were cycling through Volpe at that time. You know, were really into the idea of a car that they didn't have to register and they didn't have to insure. They just pump gas in it and rod around the city from bar to bar, engaging in that favorite sport of car salesmen from time immemorial, drunk driving. So the first day I show up on this job, let me see if you'll find my place here. I don't really need to read, but maybe I do. The first day I show up on the job, I'm greeted with the news that one of my new colleagues, Jim Waterman, nicknamed Crash for obvious reasons, had done it again. Redolent of either last night's bender or that morning's eye-opener, Jim Crash Waterman had wreaked thousands of dollars worth of damage upon his demo. Now, this wasn't even the second time that Waterman found himself in such violent opposition to the laws of physics. And maybe that my first day on the job, that might have been Crash's last day on the job. I want to tell you, though, about a guy whose name was Lee, spelled L-E-I-G-H, although he had taken to spelling it Lee, L-E-E. Less fey, I suppose, but he was known to one and all as Leo. Leo had salt and pepper curls, an olive complexion, and a pot belly. And he had lately been a cab driver in Las Vegas, Nevada. And before that, he'd owned a dive called the 10th Inning. It was near Silver Stadium, where the Rochester Red Wings played baseball. Leo would have gotten to work earlier, he was explaining to Vinny this one morning, if he weren't suffering from such a severe case of the piles. His asshole, he reported, was bleeding. And he had only hoped that he had not crossed into the deadly realm of fishers. This is me meeting this guy, listening to this story about his asshole. Leo. Leo would have made a better car salesman, actually. You know, if he weren't such a drunk. With his smarm. Someone used that. Anna, did you use that word? Somebody said smarm. Smarm is a great word. He would have made a better salesman with his smarm and his short-sleeve shirts. Like I said, if he wasn't such a drunk, he was a natural-born liar, and he thought fast, but those hemorrhoids and the hangovers, they were slowing Leo's roll. When Leo wasn't drinking, he was talking about drinking, And the punchline to almost all of his stories was a definitive, I was hammered. Leo was 33 years old, a young man from where I'm standing today. And although I was really little more than a, boy, he looked like he could have been, 50. The skin under his eyes was the color of ash. He had narrow shoulders. And upon one of his twig-like arms, he had a tattoo of hot stuff. He sweated vodka, and he camouflaged the runoff with English leather. He had another mania. I hesitate to call it a priority, because really, drinking was number one, and there was no second place. But to hear Leo tell it, the point of his nightly carousing was to get laid. And again, to hear Leo tell it, he was scoring almost all of the time. So the morning after a night of glory, Leo would show up again on the job, bleary and gloating, talking about, the previous evening's exploits, and it almost always went this way. He would make this pumping motion with his fist, meant to represent his powerful penis, and say, half a foot at a time. I drove her crazy. She's in love with me. That was the stories that didn't end in I was hammered, was I drove her crazy. Now, needless to say, and I guess I'm kind of ashamed to say this, but I got to tell you that I wanted to be just like Leo. I spent the next 6 months doing my best impersonation of him. You might ask yourself, well, what happened to Ernest Hemingway, right? Well, Papa got thrown over the side, and if there had been a poster available of Leo, I would have thumbtacked it to the wall behind my bed. Leo was my new hero. I learned all kinds of bad things with him as my mentor, how to borrow money against a bad check, how to blow up a credit card the instant the bank authorized you to use it, how to insinuate yourself into the life of a woman who wanted to have nothing to do with you. I think they call that stalking today. Back at Volpe Lincoln Mercury, where business was never good, we all got fired. Vinny was the first to go, and then Leo, and then me. I went to visit Leo one last time. He was unemployed. He had a refrigerator full of canned beer, and he was living with a woman, a rather ordinary woman, I thought, who seemed to be counting the minutes until I disappeared. And if Leo was driving her crazy, half a foot at a time, that was absolutely nowhere in evidence. That was the last day I saw him. And the feeling that I have is, Leo's got to be dead. It took me years to unlearn the lessons that he taught me, years and close attention and hard work, but Leo and all of those difficulties brought me to where I am, right here today with all of you. Thank you.
Peter Paviello's here for Peter. Fantastic. I'm so glad he watched this Red Eye. It's on at 3 in the morning, and, it's the show for breastfeeders, and insomniacs. Third shifters, breastfeeders, and insomniacs. We did it. Another show. I'm so glad I saw you guys on the way in. Was it fun? I mean, I saw these guys when they were kind of questioning whether they should come in and go to this mysterious show. And I said, come in. It's really good. You have a good time. So I think we did what we had to do, right? Thank you for coming, everybody. We do this the third Thursday of every month. And come back. We have, you know, people that come back again and again, and they, you know, they love it. So you will, too. We want to see your face again. Thanks to everybody. Let's hear it again for your storytellers and for your bartender and Brooklyn-based, who helps us book this show. Thanks again. We'll see you next month. Bye-bye.